The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hey there, it's The Takeaway.
Born in the United States, period.
For Friday, September 16th, 2016. Remember, if you like this podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a comment. Please, we need you. Thanks, and have a good weekend.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening.
This was an ailment that many people just power through, and that's what I thought I would do as well. I didn't want to stop. I didn't want to, you know, quit campaigning. I certainly didn't want to miss the 9/11 memorial. I got the antibiotics up and going, got the rest that I needed, and we're going on from there.
That was Hillary Clinton on Thursday in Greensboro, North Carolina, where she returned to the campaign trail after a 3-day break to recover from pneumonia. Hillary Clinton is now making up for some lost time off of the trail. Those 3 days, a freer rein for Donald Trump. So Clinton, back and campaigning, is trying to get the conversation back where she wants it to be on Donald Trump's fitness to hold the highest office.
This is about the kind of country we want to be, whether we'll make the economy work for everybody and not just those at the top, whether we will bring people together or pit Americans against each other, whether we'll work with our allies to keep us safe or put a loose cannon in charge who would risk everything.
Donald Trump, meanwhile, continues his normalization campaign, appearing less bombastic when he can. Trump got some presidential points yesterday for not insulting Hillary Clinton's stamina at the Economic Club of New York, and instead he read from notes.
It's a silent nation of jobless Americans. All you have to do is look at Flint, where I spent a lot of time, the city of Flint, and what a disaster has taken place. The jobs have been stripped from the community, and its infrastructure has totally collapsed.
On the policy side, Donald Trump did release that economic plan and tax plan this week, and a proposal to extend paid family leave to new mothers. And today, after 5 years of pushing the racist lie with which he did so much to poison American politics, Donald Trump said this.
President Barack Obama was born in the United States, period. Now we all want to get back to making America strong and great again. Thank you. Thank you very much.
One question. Has Donald Trump gotten all of the use he needs out of birtherism so that now he can discard it on the country's doorstep? Or will he be held to account for what he said? Now, most polls, though, do show a tightening gap between Clinton and Trump. The election is 52 days away, and with Hillary Clinton returning to the campaign trail now, it's a good time to drill down on the state of the race. Michael Ramlett is here. He's CEO and co-founder of Morning Consult. That's a nonpartisan media and survey research company. Michael Ramlett, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Let's assess the state of the race right now. What are the numbers telling us, and how reliable are the numbers that suggest a narrowing race between Clinton and Trump here?
I'll start with the second question. I think the numbers are very reliable. At Morning Consult, we conduct thousands of interviews every single day. We're running one of the largest likely voter and registered voter polls. And what we've seen right after the Democratic convention, Clinton was up 9 points at 46 to 37. That's narrowed down to 41-39. Similarly, this week, the CBS New York Times poll finds the race tied at 42. I think what you're seeing is that you had the post-convention bounce. It lasted longer than many expected it would or has historically. But what you're seeing is in the last few weeks, all but every major poll is seeing a tighter race than what they saw at the end of August.
So you're seeing this as a consistent result across polls and across platforms. And that's important because that suggests a real effect, not just a numbers effect.
That's right. And there's obviously a difference between national polls and state polls. What we've seen in some of the recent state polls is a similar effect. I think at a national level, you just have more polling data to say with greater confidence that the race is definitely tightened.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the state polls, because as we have to remind ourselves every time we have this conversation every 4 years, those are the important ones. The national poll is a headline. The state polls really matter. Tightening in Ohio and Iowa. Let's start with those two, because these were two important places where Hillary has had a lead so far.
That's right. Ohio, Iowa. I'd also would throw in there Florida, Nevada, and Arizona, as well as Pennsylvania. These are states where you have to see Trump continue to make up ground to be competitive in the Electoral College. One of the unique things we do at Morning Consult, because we do over 20,000 interviews a month, we do a 50-state analysis each month. We released ours last week. We have Clinton at 332 Electoral College votes versus Trump's 206. But it's important to know with Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, it's easy to make up ground in the Electoral College. And so I think what we saw here in the last week, there was a Bloomberg poll out, a CNN poll in Ohio, that both similarly found Trump competing much more competitively. The interesting nuance to all of these polls, and important for your listeners, is that there's a difference between registered voters and likely voters. If you look at a lot of the polls before Labor Day, it's almost all registered voters. And the actual turnout of registered voters is about 87% to 90%. So in 2012, 87% of registered voters actually went to the polls and voted on Election Day or prior to Election Day. In the case of 2008, you had a record high or near record high of 90%. So it's important to know as we go into the fall here is that you're looking at likely voters, and not every likely voter model is the same. So it's just important to know that that's some of the nuance that you're going to see in some of the noise around different polls.
Okay, one of the effects that we've seen so far in this race is that when things do get closer between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, it's usually Hillary doing worse, going down, and Donald Trump having a hard time breaking his hard ceiling of, I don't know, 42%, 43%. Does that persist, or is Donald Trump succeeding in winning over a lot of these moderate Republicans or queasy independents who may vote for a Republican usually, but they're uneasy about Donald Trump?
I think it's important to note, actually, that they have both very low ceilings. Neither one of them have broken the 50% gap. And I think that it's important to note that because you have historically the two most unpopular candidates. And so seeing major shifts one direction or the other is probably not expected, because we're not talking about a candidate that's introducing themselves to the American public for the first time. What we're seeing, and you're seeing this with the third-party candidates, is that in many cases, the public in general is very upset about both candidates. So you see a much higher number with a Gary Johnson. You see some support going to Jill Stein. I think it's noteworthy in that you have the change in media narrative, especially here in the last week. To provide some context for your listeners, 80% of Americans said that they had read, heard, or seen something about the health scare this weekend. We were the first poll out, and one of the questions we asked was sort of, what are the overall context of the health issues this weekend? And what you're finding with Clinton is that they reinforce around this issue of trustworthiness. And I think what we found in the poll was over 50% of Americans felt that she had not been trustful about the issues around her health this weekend. And certainly the diagnosis on Friday is something that really plays into the media narrative. But I think in general, what you're finding is that that shift back and forth is really in the 40s to high 30s.
Okay. And Donald Trump, it's been analyzed since the beginning, well, at least since the beginning of the general election, even though they both have a ceiling, that his main mission to win in a place like Pennsylvania and have a path to the White House is to convince, you know, a lot of Republicans, former Republicans, or people who did vote for John McCain or Mitt Romney, that they can vote for Trump. They can get in his basket, as I've said on this show. Is that effect happening?
I think that's what you're looking to see play out here in Ohio and Pennsylvania, is that he certainly does better with sort of the classical Reagan Democrats. And I think what you're beginning to see here, and potentially this is a narrative that'll play out over the weekend, is on the birther issue, what effect does that have with African Americans? Certainly, Secretary Clinton really succeeded in the primaries in large part because of the diversity of her coalition. And so you have this issue playing out where the degree to which Trump can appeal to more working class white Americans and more of the industrial Midwest. At the same time, the issue set for Clinton, especially in states like Florida, or you look to the Southwest like Arizona or New Mexico, you know, the issues around Hispanic and Latino voter participation will play out here this fall.
Hillary Clinton is weaker with younger voters. We've seen this the entire race, much weaker with young voters than she needs to be. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, both hitting the campaign trail for Hillary in Ohio this weekend. It seems like they're going after those very voters where Hillary needs some help.
Yeah, I think this is a question about surrogates in general, is surrogates oftentimes are important or play maybe a bigger role for candidates who may be lesser known. But in the case of Trump and Clinton, they just have such high recognition, whether it's name ID, picture ID, and the sort of overall concern about the unpopularity of each individual candidate. I'm just not sure the degree to which one surrogate, whether it was Warren or whether it was Sanders, are going to make a huge difference. I think what's going to play out here is sort of a look to the fall. You have a major presidential debate here on September 26th. That's really going to be potentially the largest televised event, certainly this year, if not in history. And I think what you're going to see is a potential for that to reshape the race. You're going to see it play out through debate season. Unfortunately, there could be an event like a terrorism event that could shape how national security plays into it. And then you have to look to the get-out-the-vote operations. Clinton campaign has invested a lot in turning out voters. Not as much investment from the Trump campaign, but you've seen the RNC try to play a bigger role in that space as well.
Hillary Clinton is back on the trail after a break to recover from her illness. Donald Trump is busy normalizing his campaign, trying to make it appear less racist and more normal and cast him more presidential. Michael Ramlett, co-founder and CEO of Morning Consult, setting the race for us yet again. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dad.
Welcome back to Star Talk.
Neil deGrasse Tyson believes that each and every one of us has a geek underbelly, and his goal for decades has been trying to coax it to the surface with his writings, his speeches, and radio and TV shows. But Tyson is flipping the script in the upcoming third season of Star Talk. Fewer astrophysicists, cosmologists, mathematicians, they have their own crowd. Instead, how about people like Ben Stiller, Whoopi Goldberg, even Defense Secretary Ash Carter? Tyson is taking the pop culture route to our inner geek. He'll find the science in you yet. The third season of Star Talk premieres on September 19th on Nat Geo. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me back.
We will get to the show. We'll get to the book, I promise. Can we talk about Proxima B for a minute before we get there?
Are you distracted by this discovery?
You know, you don't get Neil deGrasse Tyson every day, and I have questions, if you don't mind.
Okay. Bring it on.
Proxima B, the star only 4 light years from Earth, as we heard a couple of weeks ago.
The closest star to the sun.
4 light years. One of the exciting things about this was the possibility of travel there. How practically possible is that? And what are your ideas for a chance that we could get to a planet in that system at 4 light years distance?
Well, if you're on a beam of light, it would take 4 years, but we don't know how to do that yet. So the fastest spaceships we've ever launched, it would take, 50, 60,000 years.
Yeah.
So the answer is no, we're not going there. <I'm sorry.
laughs> That's a downer. But people were excited, though, about the possibility of small, iPhone-sized probes, which I assume can be accelerated to much, much faster speeds.
Yeah, in the current idea, you would propel them with light pressure by lasers from Earth. And it's possible to accelerate to very high speeds and get there in much less time. I think it's more of a demonstration of what might be possible. And I'm skeptical, but somebody's got to be thinking this stuff up.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to get in anybody's way who's thinking they want to send iPhone-sized probes. A world where people like that don't exist is a world where you have never left the cave to begin with.
No question about it. And the skepticism is exactly what you need here for honest scientific inquiry. Now, you did Cosmos in front of a huge television audience on Fox. What's different here with Star Talk? Is it a similar kind of conversation you're having, or does it go in other directions?
Star Talk is a different species. It is the first ever talk show on science to air on television. Ever. And we didn't do that with that in mind. We just look back and say, wait a minute, this has never happened before. And we just ask the question, how do you reach people who don't know they like science? Or better yet, people who are sure they don't like science. How do you reach them? What we did was inverted the model. I'm the host, and my guest is hardly ever a scientist. They come from the scaffold of pop culture that we carry with us every day, in politics, in entertainment, in performance arts, in all the rest of these categories. And I have a conversation with them about all the ways science or technology has touched their lives. And at its best, it reveals kind of a geek underbelly that so many people have, but they have no other occasion to reveal it.
And that's what I want to ask you about, because you have talked about that geek underbelly. I think of it more of an outer coating. I mean, underbelly's fine. I suppose. if you're
you
a beautiful
like
celebrity,
candy bar ads. It's geek nougat on the inside. Yeah, so if you wear it on the outside, then it's less of a reveal, of course. Our first guest this year is Whoopi Goldberg. The people in the know that she played a recurring character in Star Trek Next Generation.
Right.
But she's also a huge fan of science fiction in general. And part of my conversation with her was about her fantasies about there being a superhero who looks just like her. And... she said, a superhero with an ass that's a little fatter than other people's.
That's Whoopi.
Just somebody and with special powers specific to her nature.
I want to see, you know, somebody who saves the Earth, whose behind is a little bit bigger, whose chest is on the floor. But when that, it's a superpowers kick in, ooh. She could slap a whole nation of people. You don't find a lot of humor. It's just like...
And so it's just fun to talk with people and have them just think freely. Now, by the way, how much science is in superheroes? Well, there's a lot to talk about there. There are books, The Science of Superheroes, The Physics of Superheroes. And so there are a lot of places to go when pop culture is the foundation and the science is what you're going to clad onto it. Now, so this show is not, it's not one of these controversial talk shows. I mean, but it's all just an exploration of how and why science matters. Because if that doesn't come across, if we fail at that, and there aren't other ways for this to reach people who don't think about science, I don't know what the future of our country or civilization will bring.
We are in the throes at the same time of an election. You get any politicians on this show or talk about the science of how they lie to us or the,
the science of misrepresenting the truth? I try to get good politicians on each season. So we had Bill Clinton in the conversation with him. This was in the first season. One of the stories I got from him was that on one of the table in the Oval Office where, you know, heads of state sit around and argue, he said he had on loan from NASA a moon rock that sat in the middle of the table. And any time a conversation was not working out or tensions were rising, he would say, pause.
You see that moon rock? It's 3.6 billion years old. Now, we're all just passing through here, and we don't have very much time. So let's just calm down and figure out what the right thing to do is. And it worked every single time.
That rock is 4.5 billion years old, and it's from the moon. And then it was, oh, so he would reset the conversation with this cosmic perspective. And the cosmic perspective is something that I and my colleagues occasionally take for granted, but we live it. And it's the point of view that however important you think you are relative to other people, a cosmic perspective will tell you that you are not different or distinct from others. We are participants in a great unfolding of a cosmic story. And that can have important consequences if you want to invade another country to move a border. If you just look at Earth from space where there are no borders, maybe you'll think differently about it or a little more holistically about the fate of people on Earth.
Star Talk, the book, has a wondrous-looking Neil deGrasse Tyson on the cover surrounded by flying skulls, planets, and space shuttles. And the show Star Talk premieres September 19th on Nat Geo. Neil deGrasse Tyson, what a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
And now we're going to have, oh, you know that friend. Who is that? Curious George. And this time we're going to do Curious George Takes a Job.
I had that book once.
I did.
Good. All right. Let's be very quiet now, all right? Here we go. This is George.
There's a sound familiar to millions of children and former children around the world. The story of a mischievous little monkey who's had one of the longest careers of any childhood actor out there. Curious George was born from the imaginations of Hans and Margaret Ray. They were a team. Hans drew George. Margaret brought him to life with her storytelling.
Curious George is, he's not a typical animal. He's just Curious George, you know. He's a curious monkey who, through his curiosity, gets himself into trouble. And through his own ingenuity, gets himself out of trouble.
That's Margaret Ray speaking back in 1985. She died in 1996. Her husband died nearly two decades before her. But filmmaker Emma Ryan Yamazaki is trying to preserve the Ray story now so that their life of adventure and ingenuity can live on along with the character that they created. Yamazaki is currently working on a forthcoming documentary about the Rays. It's called Monkey Business, The Adventures of George's Curious Creators.
There were German Jews who fled the Nazis on bicycles with the first Curious George book with them back in 1940 out of Paris, and they ultimately got to America as refugees and published that first Curious George book in 1941 and then wrote six more, and then the rest is history. Right now, Curious George is a TV star, a movie star. He's on our toothbrushes. You know, he's at a kid's birthday party, napkins. So, yeah, that's who they were.
Hans and Margaret Ray, they had no children of their own, but they invented this character that children for generations afterward, including myself, have just loved.
Yeah, yeah, and around the world, right? So I grew up in Japan reading Curious George in Japanese, assuming he was a Japanese monkey. I mean, I never questioned that. And then it took me, you know, years later to find out that so many countries were claiming him. And when I came to the U.S., it was one of those few things that I could share with my new American friends from my childhood because so many of them had read Curious George. And so he's universal and timeless, which, you know, is incredible.
And how do you say Curious George in Japanese?
We know him as Osaru no Joji. But also there's two names. There's another one called Hitomane Kozaru, which is like a mimicking monkey. So there's two names.
Well, your movie tells a story of a Ray couple who were ingenious in their own right and had to use a lot of ingenuity to get out of jams, to get out of trouble, sort of like their character. There seems to be reflections of this little monkey's personality in the way they lived.
Yeah, the more I learned about the Rays and their personalities and their life experiences, it became so clear to me that the reason why we have Curious George is because of who the Rays were and their life experiences, you know. So I can't help but see a bit of George in each of them, their curiosity, their sense of adventure, and their resilience. You know, they're survivors. The specific example, the most clear one I can make is, you know, when they were fleeing the Nazis, they found themselves in no train to be had and no cars, and they had to get out of Paris, and they couldn't even find bicycles. They only found a tandem bike. And the wife wasn't going to tolerate riding a tandem bike to flee the Nazis. So she told her husband, you know, I'm not doing this, figure out something. And he built two bicycles out of spare parts overnight. And those makeshift bicycles was what they rode to flee the Nazis, you know. So really it was through their creativity and imagination that they got out of serious trouble.
Well, I really love this part of your trailer.
We did only what we liked. And by a nice coincidence, the children liked the same thing.
Did you talk to children?
No. Why should we? We couldn't learn anything from them.
Margaret Ray, why should we talk to kids?
I know, right? So I got a chance to talk to a lot of people that grew up near the Rays as children, neighbors in this Waterville Valley community out in New Hampshire. And it was interesting how, you know, the kids had magical memories of Hans Ray. You know, he was just a man that never lost that sense of childhood. And then Margaret, people were scared of her as a kid. And it was only later, once they became older, that they appreciated her more and things like that. So she was a little bit blunt, you know, just straightforward.
And she intimidated people?
Some people have said that, you know, but she was really the one that got things done. You know, it was really Hans did do those drawings, but she wrote all the words. And it was her that, you know, went to Brazil in the 30s, having found that Hans, they knew each other in childhood, and he was doing like an account keeping job. And she was the one that said, Hans, you're too talented to be a bookkeeper. Let's do something creative together. And they got married. They started an advertising company and ultimately started writing children's books.
So what made you want to get started on this project? Was it a love of George yourself or just what you thought might be a lucrative film? I mean, you started on this documentary probably without enough money. Your Kickstarter has been successful, so it's going to get finished. But I don't think you knew where this was going to end up when you started.
No, not at all. And I started, I happened upon the race story in spring of 2014. So a while back now, and I had made a couple of short films as a director, and I had done quite a lot of work as an editor in documentaries and nonfiction television. I was really looking for a story that I could throw myself into. I knew a feature film would take a couple of years, and I was searching for a story. And that's when I was introduced to the Ray Estate, run by Miss Lely Ong, who is in charge of all their stuff. And never knew anything about the Curious George authors. I mean, as kids, right, we never asked, like, who wrote our books? And I think as adults, too, like, we don't get that chance. And once I asked that question and found out more about them, I got completely obsessed. I traveled around the country meeting people that knew the Rays when they were alive. And also, there's an archive at the University of Southern Mississippi. There's 300 boxes of things from the Rays' life, like wartime journals and letters they wrote each other, and even the process of how Curious George was made, like unpublished sketches and their editing process. And I spent weeks there piecing their story together, and that's how I got started.
You know, my sister is a children's author. She'll be published soon. She has young kids. She had twins. She raised them and came up with great ideas for kids' books. What's astonishing here is that the Rays never had children and yet had such astronomical success, not financially, but coming up with a concept with art and with stories that not just a few kids, not a couple of kids in town, but millions and millions and millions of children, no matter who they were, just got right into.
And they really drew from their own experiences, from their childhood and stories they heard. They little known fact that, you know, in almost all their books, you can find them drawn into the story. So they love to really draw from their own experiences. They put their friends in their books, you know, and it was really, you know, it wasn't like, as someone says in my film, it wasn't like they searched the moon to find the storylines, right? It was all kind of inspired by their outlook on normal things. And that's transcended time for sure.
Well, generations of art and drawing and children's books that we all know and love of Curious George, and a new film thanks to a successful Kickstarter campaign called Monkey Business, The Adventure of George's Curious Creators. Emma Ryan Yamazaki is the filmmaker. She's the director, the producer, and the bringer to life of this film. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
We return to Detroit now. On Thursday's show, we heard about the revitalization of downtown in Detroit. It's an area once marred by vacancies and blight. It's now booming with new businesses, luxury goods, and tech startups. But who is this new downtown for? That's a question that's worried longtime residents there. And it's an issue Max Nussenbaum and Dextina Booker are navigating themselves. Max and Dextina are featured in the new documentary Generation Startup. It chronicles the stories of six young entrepreneurs who moved to Detroit as part of Venture for America. That's an organization placing startups in emerging cities and trying to have a positive impact while creating jobs at the same time. Now, Max and Dextina are well aware of the tension in Detroit, and they're trying to be part of the city, not create a new one.
I think my view is a lot more realistic and fact-based. Like, I think a lot of people come here and they're like, we're going to save Detroit and it's going to be amazing. There's so much property, you know, and some of that may be true. But when you get here and you realize that it's not a blank canvas, there are people here. There are people who've been here and like they've been doing their thing long before I even got here. You kind of start to realize that you're plugging in, not painting over.
Max Nussenbaum, you're one of the people who's sort of painting on this canvas that Dextina is talking about, because you've got a startup, Castle, basically an app, an interface for landlords and tenants to do property management. I mean, you're one of the people dealing at the very center of Detroit's decline and potential rebirth, which is housing, which is real estate.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I very much echo what Dextina says. I think it's really common in media about Detroit for, you know, tech startups, especially tech startups helmed by, you know, young white men to get a really disproportionate share of the attention. And while I certainly believe that entrepreneurship is going to be a key part of Detroit's recovery, I think it's really important that that story of entrepreneurship isn't just focused on tech startups that are a really narrow sliver, but includes the restaurant owners and the nonprofit starters and all the people who've contributed to their local communities through businesses and in many other ways. I think for us, one thing that really motivates me and really motivates all of the Castle team is that, when we do our jobs right, we're helping to make the experience of rental housing better for people in Detroit and all over southeastern Michigan, and we're not doing it at sort of the high-end sliver of the market that gets the most attention, all the new luxury buildings in downtown, but rather in sort of the single-family homes and duplexes that are in the neighborhoods and in the suburbs, and that are really where, you know, if you pick a person who lives in Detroit out of a jar, 99 times out of 100, that's where they're going to be living, and not in one of these downtown high-rises that you often hear about. So there's no question. I think it's really motivating for us to be able to contribute to that in some small way. But at the same time, I'm always very, while grateful for any attention that Castle gets, always want to do whatever I can to make sure that it's not presented as a sort of tiny myopic viewpoint of, ooh, these kids and their tech startups bringing Detroit back. Because I think that's very far from the real truth.
And so when you're in the neighborhoods, when you're helping make these deals and participating in real estate, Max, you must have encountered on the ground the very tension that Dextina is talking about and that everybody talks about with new economy coming into old Detroit and the baggage that comes along with that.
Absolutely. I mean, part of our job is to be, we think of as sort of a neutral buffer between a property owner and a tenant, which can often be kind of an emotionally explosive relationship. And that could be an emotionally explosive relationship anywhere, let alone in a city that has, some of the history and some of the baggage that Detroit does. I would say about 25% of the time that a customer is interested in using Castle, we actually have to turn them down. And often that is because it'll be obvious from our sales team's conversation with them that they're not interested in maintaining the property up to what our standard would be, or they'll say something that's frankly bigoted or offensive about Detroit. And honestly, we have to sort of curate our customer base to make sure we're not helping those people do things that we would consider, morally offensive and harmful to the city. Of course, that's the vast minority of real estate investors that we deal with. The vast majority of them are people who want to be contributing to the fabric of Detroit and to Michigan, and who are motivated by the fact that investing in real estate isn't just buying an asset like a stock or a bond. It's providing someone with shelter, that most basic human need. And most real estate investors are really compassionate and motivated by that. But there's no question that there's a small percentage who don't have the attitude about it that connects with what we think makes real estate have so much potential and be so exciting. And it's something we do see a lot in our work.
Well, Dextina, we've heard Detroit described as this living laboratory for revitalization. You like living in a lab?
I'm not really plugged in with the laboratory side of the Detroit experience. I think when I got here, I made the decision to jump in and try to live as authentically as I could.
And you're a newcomer in that city who has made it your business, right, to shop where people sell local crafts. I saw that you tutor down at the boxing gym. That's something.
Yeah, the boxing gym is my favorite activity. Every Thursday, that's where I am.
What does that do for you, being down at the gym and interacting with those kids and helping them train?
So I mostly help with tutoring, mainly focus on tutoring and math, but I'll, help out with whatever they need. Like, I went through the fifth grade. I think I could help. Working with the kids, like, I think it's something that I would have done no matter where I went. It was something that I've always been interested in. They remind me of, like, the people I grew up with. And working with them is really, it's amazing because it's the main constant in my life. I've had three jobs since I've been here, and the one thing that hasn't changed is boxing for me. So they are, like, as much a part of my community as I am a part of theirs. And I look forward to every week going there and talking to D'Angelo about Steven Universe, the one cartoon, and his favorite characters and songs from the show. And, working with Sydney on writing her essays, it's a part of my Detroit experience. It's kind of just what I do, and they're my community. So it's really awesome working with them.
That's Dextina Booker and Max Nussenbaum speaking with us from Detroit. Guys, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was fun.
Dextina Booker is a mechanical engineer working at Shinola in Detroit, and Max Nussenbaum is the co-founder and CEO of Castle. That's an app-based property management system. Dextina and Max are two of the six young entrepreneurs featured in the new documentary, Generation Startup. It's in theaters later this month.
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You just don't get it, do you?
You still don't get it, do you?
You don't get it, do you?
Oh, you just don't get it, do you?
Huh? You don't get it, do you?
get it. Your movie fix. It's Friday, talking about the weekend's movie releases here on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday and our all-star film helper. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Great to have you here. Now, we're going to review two films and a quick third one today. However, the biggest release of the weekend is Snowden,
yep,
by Oliver Stone. We're going to get to that in a second. Here's trivia, by the way. Guys, don't answer yet. If you know the answer, you can tweet me, and we'll come back to it at the end of the segment. Here it is. Snowden out this week, as I said, directed by Oliver Stone. Here's your question, Rafer. JFK is one of Oliver Stone's most famous films. Who played Lee Harvey Oswald in that movie? People forget this. That's your question. We're going to come back to it. Tweet me if you know the answer. Now, Rafer, Snowden by Oliver Stone, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Edward Snowden. Here's a clip.
Our government is hemorrhaging billions of dollars every year to Chinese hackers. And I've been hired to shut them down. A lot of people are depending on me.
More so than anyone else?
Yes.
So we're kind of going beyond the headlines and the coverage of Edward Snowden, getting into his personal life here.
Yeah, I think what this film is really trying to do is sort of lay out the development of the arc of Edward Snowden's journey as he goes from true believer and kind of a conservative. You know, when he first joins the CIA, he says one of his big influences, Ayn Rand. But his girlfriend, the Shailene Woodley, who plays Lindsay Mills, you heard her there in that clip, she's a little bit more of a liberal. And it's not exactly her that turns him, but the things that he sees at the CIA, the evidence of this massive wiretapping, there's a little bit of a spy subplot during Edward Snowden's short time as a field operative, where he sees the sort of the wrecking, the damaging of innocent lives and how this can play out. I think what Oliver Stone really wants to do here is sort of make a case that Snowden's motivations were sincere and genuine. Whether you approve of his methods or not or of what he did, he wasn't trying to damage the country. He wasn't trying to sell secrets to a foreign interest. He was really just trying to be a whistleblower.
He has a penchant for conspiracy theorizing, Oliver Stone. Does this film steer clear of that?
It does. This is not the hysterical Oliver Stone of JFK, and it's not really the black and white Oliver Stone of Platoon even. It's pretty, I'm not going to say even-handed because it's very sympathetic, but it's pretty even-keeled in its tone, and I think that helps it.
It's a movie I'm going to see because it's obviously a world that I'm extremely interested in, and I just think that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, man, he's got the affect down.
He's amazing at it.
He really does. Now, let's go to rom-com land. Bridget Jones's Baby, starring Renee Zellweger. This is the third in the Bridget Jones franchise, right?
That's correct.
A few months ago, on the 4th of the month, I met Jack at a music festival, and we got on very well and sort of had relations. And the next week, that is to say on the 11th of the month, Mark and I, well, we had similar relations. And owing to these relations, the resulting life form currently residing in my tummy could actually, in fact, be either of yours.
Worth seeing?
You know, I went in with pretty low expectations, but it's actually quite charming. The cast is still really good. The original director, Sharon Maguire, who did the first one, is back. And there's some very fun moments. And surprisingly, they make it work.
All right, great. Now, I think we do have to touch quickly on the new Blair Witch reboot. Blair Witch Project, the original selfie in American film, the original viral marketing campaign. The new Blair Witch is out. What do you think?
You know, it's a sequel. I'm not sure why. It feels like a remake. It's the same tricks, the same stuff over and over. And here's my big gripe with this new Blair Witch. Don't show me the Blair Witch. That's the whole point of the movie, is that you never see her. Don't show her to me. I was very angry about that, Todd.
And people are used to camera selfies now. It's no longer an interesting device.
I agree. I think this whole genre that Blair Witch started, Paranormal Activity, all these movies, I think they've really just run their course. Although I'm wrong, because they keep coming out.
Maybe people keep spending money on them.
I guess.
Go back to trivia before we let you go now. Oliver Stone is directing Snowden this week, JFK, one of his most famous films. And Rafer, I asked you, who played Lee Harvey Oswald in JFK?
Gary Oldman.
Oh, you got it.
Yes.
What a great role. People forget about how great Gary Oldman was in that film.
Yes.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Todd. You too.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The 68th Emmy Awards are on Sunday. You can go to the internet and Google all the nominees, and there's plenty of coverage out there about the best comedies, the best dramas, the best shows that are up for awards. But what's really worth checking out? That's the question. The Emmys are fine, But we have some of our own TV categories to get Melissa Locker talking. Melissa is culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and for us here at The Takeaway. Melissa, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
All right, of course, the Emmys has the best drama category. How about, why don't we do best drama to binge watch with no break whatsoever?
I think you can't go wrong with things like Game of Thrones, although you may start sword wielding, Better Call Saul, although you may suddenly feel the urge to go to law school, God forbid. Bloodline make you want to move to Florida. But, you know, they're very good escapist dramas that you can absolutely lose yourself in. I would not recommend binge watching Ray Donovan, though, because that will go to your head.
Alternatively, you know, often TV is at its best when you're paying little to no attention at all. How about best show to put on as background noise while you're doing something more important?
I don't think you could possibly go wrong having Empire playing in the background because they do have really good songs. I would not recommend Game of Thrones, people getting slaughtered.
Also too detailed.
Yeah, but also just the sound effects of people getting slaughtered and or eaten, not necessarily what you want in the background.
We do want to talk about the best comedy to watch with your cat, otherwise known as When Single.
I don't know how your cat will feel about Aziz Ansari, but I really liked Master of None, which is on Netflix. I also think that Blackish and Veep are really cat friendly.
How about the best show to watch with your parents that may or may not make things weird?
Definitely watch The Americans with your parents because they can probably explain all the 80s references that you might have been too young to catch the first time around. But be aware because they definitely are on cable TV and are not primetime family friendly. So there are some scenes in there that are definitely going to make things very awkward with your parents, or at least revisit the whole birds and bees topic.
I see. So like you're going to wind up watching a sex scene with your folks, cringeworthy.
Yes. Well, it depends what you like to watch with your parents, in between you and them.
Now, I would like to talk about the all-important Veep category. How many of the categories is Veep going to sweep? Is it all of the categories or almost all of the categories? How well will Veep do?
I believe that Veep is going to win absolutely every category, even categories they're not really nominated in, just because the series was so good this year.
Big news.
Oh, God, O'Brien made a statement.
I'm sorry. I should have said big personal news. Oh. Wendy and I are adopting a baby from China.
Oh.
We were keeping a secret till after the election. Actually, Wendy was keeping it a secret from me until today because I'm so bad with keeping secrets. But I'm going to be a dad.
Oh. You're an nincompoop. We are in the middle of a tied election. There is no time for some Chinese baby. Cancel it and see if you can get your money back.
Meanwhile, I will say Mr. Robot is nominated in the Real Emmys, Melissa, Best Drama Series. I am getting hectored, hounded by friends. Why have you not watched Mr. Robot yet?
You obviously don't have your priorities straight. This is an incredible show. Not only does it have Christian Slater, who, you know, everyone should love, but it's also just a really good show and kind of a dark, like, drama about the internet and the kind of powers that work behind the scenes. And you have plenty of time to go catch up and watch all of them before the next season.
Oh, Melissa, I do want to get to another important real-life category, Best Animated Show About a Depressed, Washed-Up Horse Actor, starring Amy Sedaris and Paul F. Tompkins.
Clearly, you're talking about BoJack Horseman, who has already won all the Oscars.
BoJack thought he was winning an Oscar. Turns out the categories were all fake. Imagine that.
I'm as shocked as he is. I thought he was going to win.
How hard should people be watching BoJack if they haven't watched it already?
It should be their full-time business.
That's Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, for The Guardian, and for us here at The Takeaway. Thanks.
Thank you.
Come a little bit closer. Hear what I
And here's something to take with you today. The harvest moon, the full moon closest to the autumnal equinox, will rise this evening. Now, September 22nd will mark the official start of autumn. In Europe, Africa, and Asia, the full moon will be slightly darker because of a penumbral lunar eclipse. Now, scientists are debating whether to call it a super moon. That's when a new or a full moon is almost as close as it can get to Earth. Neil deGrasse Tyson is not buying this. Here he is on Star Talk Radio back in 2013.
All right, so there's something called a supermoon.
Okay.
I don't know who first called it a supermoon.
All right.
I don't know, but if you have a 16-inch pizza Would you call that a super pizza compared with a 15-inch pizza? The supermoon is a 16-inch pizza compared with a 15-inch pizza. It's a slightly bigger moon. I ain't using the adjective supermoon.
Whatever you call it, it's going to rise around 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, so have a great harvest. You can subscribe to our podcast in the meantime on iTunes. You can give us a rating there. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. But have a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.